On March 6, 2011, one of the most infamous reality TV shows graced our screens and became an instant classic. Love & Hip Hop was a franchise centered around following the personal and professional lives of formerly famous or hip-hop adjacent people and their love lives. Now, this show started in New York, as we all know. One of the most iconic scenes is Chrissy beating the brakes off of Kimbella in that one scene when they're in the penthouse, child. But no one can compare to the impact Love & Hip Hop Atlanta had on our lives.
Don't be touching up on me.
Okay. You're not gonna speak?
Hey, maid. I see you got on your May outfit like you always do.
I don't blame you.
Maid,
you
got a queen.
The love triangle between Mimi Foss, Jocelyn Hernandez, and Stevie J had us gripping and certified Love & Hip Hop as a classic in our community. Mona Scott Young, the creator and founder of Love & Hip Hop, had many various careers in the entertainment industry before she decided to create this show, as it became a runaway hit with Love & Hip Hop Atlanta and slowly began expanding its way across the nation with Love & Hip Hop Miami and Love & Hip Hop Hollywood to quickly follow. At first, Mona Scott was applauded for her contributions to the Black community and the creation of this show. She was held to a high standard in the reality TV industry, and a lot of people loved her for her success. Well, after a while, the Black community started to turn their backs on her, blaming her for all of the systemic issues that were plaguing the Black community to this day. They pointed their finger at her and made sure that she held the blame for why Black women act like that or why Black men can't seem to settle down, and glorifying sex and drugs in the entertainment industry. I roll. As COVID took over and Love & Hip Hop and shows similar were struggling to find a way to continue to film while the world was being shut down, and its slow descent into irrelevancy finally really began, another network came out of nowhere and took the baton from Love & Hip Hop and began not running, but sprinting with that bitch. July 13th, 2018, something shook the room in the reality TV industry, and that was the creation and the launching of the Zeus Network. Now, I have made a video about the Zeus Network, my commentary on the Zeus Network and how I feel about the Zeus Network. I will link it in the bio. It's one of my older videos, but it's still good to this day. I personally have held a Zeus Network subscription since 2018 and continue to re-up on that bitch every single year. And I get the yearly. Yeah. The Zeus Network, if you don't know, is an urban reality TV streaming platform. Now they're expanding into more scripted things. I know they just landed the first scripted show. We'll see how that goes. It made its reputation in the form of reality TV. They were known for shows like The Conversation, where two sworn reality TV enemies were paid to sit in front of each other and scream at each other about why or why not they no longer are friends or no longer get along. There were shows like Black China's reality TV show that had so many memes. It's insane.
I'm ready to get the fuck ASAP after this shit.
5 days.
You put your hand in my face again, girl.
5 days.
You're going to stretch your ass across this motherfucking kitchen. You better keep your motherfucking hand out of my face.
5 days.
Don't touch me no more. You do it again, I'm going to rock your world in this motherfucker.
So rock it.
Cut the cameras, dead ass, where they followed Blac Chyna and her life and the people around her and what she did all day. I love Blac Chyna. And maybe I'll do a separate video on that another time. They had semi-scripted, I would say, ensemble cast dating shows circa early 2000s, Love, I Love New York, and Flavor of Love, and all of that kind of thing, where they'd live in one mansion, and they'd all compete for the love of one famous influencer or famous person in the industry. They also had, of course, one of my personal faves, with Love & Hip Hop alumni, Atlanta alumni, Jocelyn Hernandez, the famous show Jocelyn's Cabaret, where Jocelyn Hernandez was fulfilling her dream of becoming a cabaret madam with girls in a performance that she would take across the country and sell out tours doing, which she is doing now. It was a deep dive into the world of 304s, stripper culture, lots of things that most of us don't really get in our day-to-day lives, but I think it's an important show.
You question me about fighting for you? You don't question no boss, bitch. I thought that I really could do the cabaret with you and her. But you threw that off, bitch. You threw her opportunity away. Because now I don't trust her because you. You threw all your opportunity away because, bitch, we don't, I don't need y'all. I could do a cabaret without y'all. So you could.
Again, refer to my Zeus Network video if you want more detail on how I feel about these shows individually. Now, the Zeus Network completely revolutionized what reality TV could be. Because they owned their IP, they owned the platform that they were streaming their stuff on, and everyone paid in behind a paywall with a monthly or yearly subscription, they could show everything. And when I say everything, I mean everything. Nudity, fighting, things that would go way farther than it would ever go on any good season of Bad Girls Club. And as the rise of the Zeus Network kind of came at the fall of the existence of Love and Hip Hop, a new ire of the Black community started to take form. The Zeus Network became the reason for everything. It became the reason why Black men and Black women keep fighting, the reason why there's colorism in our community, the reason why people are toting guns and joining gangs in our community. It became the reason for all of the issues within the Black community today. The Zeus Network became the person to blame, the thing to blame for everything going wrong in the Black community. Girl, the Zeus Network, I don't know if you knew this, is behind 9/11. Yeah, see, come closer. Can I tell you a secret? Come closer. I don't think the Black community is ruined. Is that too bold to say? Saying the Black community is ruined has so much finality to it. Just negative finality. There's no way it can be saved. There's no way it can be revived. There's no hope in community building and building hope within us. To me, the Black community is traumatized. And who wouldn't with the history that we've had? We are traumatized people with generational trauma pumping through our veins that continues to be triggered every single day based on us living in a society that barely sees us as human, if they do, and at that barely respects our perspective. They only come to us when it's too late and listen to us when it's too late and demand that we help them. Imagine how frustrating that is. Unfortunately, the brainwashing worked. I think too many of my people die on the hill of white capitalism and white Jesus and use that as a lens that they don't even know they're looking within to judge their own people. The Black community isn't ruined. It's traumatized, and even in all its trauma, it still limped along to break records, to create culture, to be some of the most influential people to walk this earth. So you wanted to know who or what ruined the Black community. No, it's not the Zeus Network, and no, it's not Mona Scott Young, and Natalie Nunn, or Jocelyn, or Sexy Red, or Glorilla, or women twerking, or feminism. It's slavery.
Whoa. Before we go any further, I need to interact with you a little bit, just like you should be interacting with this video. Yeah. Okay? Like the video. It won't hurt you. It won't cost you anything. Subscribe to the channel. Yeah. Interact with this. Comment. Comment your thoughts. We need the engagement to boost us in the algorithm. We're small but mighty, and I want to grow. That's number one. Number two, I just thought, since I don't have any sponsors yet, if you're a sponsor, reach out to me. But I thought, I have ad space to fill with my own shit, so why not do it? So, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to advertise one of the most important cornerstones of the Madiswan channel that I've been working on while I've been away. Let's talk about it. That, my dears, is my Substack. So if you've never heard about Substack, come close. Let's talk about it a little bit. It is but another way for us to talk with each other more directly, create community, and for you to get to know me more as a person. My Substack is basically like an email list turned webpage turned blog turned podcast. It's a bunch of different things, child. Now, my Substack is called The Swan Letter because I'm Matt Swan and this is the Matt Swan channel, and you guys are all my little swans. Yeah. The Swan Letter is going to be all things me, all things content, all things more deeply me. And I'm excited to explain a little bit about that to you in this ad space. I think we all need a break, get up and stretch. You know, eat your snack, go to the description, boop, down below, click the link that says Substack here, click it, click that link, and put your email in. Now, there are two ways you can subscribe to my Substack. There's a free version, and there's a paid version. In the free version, you will be able to interact with the free blog posted newsletters, okay? I might post a video here or there, if I feel compelled to, but if not, it's okay. You will get a weekly guaranteed blog post from me. Those blog posts are about my previous true crime style YouTube videos, my retrospective on those things, why I chose those cases and stuff like that. You will get a monthly blog post from me about what I'm hyperfixated with for the month, whether it's music, podcast, book, makeup, food, a place to go, something. This robe that I got for my birthday, which I love. My hyperfixations, what I'm obsessed with, recommendations, and I hope you take heed. And whatever else I want to post. I might want to post more often some months, other months I might not post as often, but you will definitely always get a weekly blog post about my YouTube videos. You will also receive a monthly blog post with my movie of the month that I'm doing on my other tier Substack that I'm doing a movie reaction to, and you will get just a rundown of what I thought about the movie, a review of the movie, and all of that kind of thing. But that's what you can expect from the free tier. So what you would do is hit the link in the description, and then you would go to the page, you type in your email, and that's it. That's all you have to do to sign up. You will be abreast of everything new that's going on the channel, what's going on with me, pretty much. Now, for the paid tier, you're going to get a little bit more. Now, you'll get all of the things that I just mentioned, of course, all access to that. You will also get an additional monthly vlog from me where I show you just different clips of what I did that month, the things I did, the people I was with, the things I loved, the things I hated, just narration of my life for the year. You will get the additional bonus episode of the month where I will be doing and uploading a movie reaction where I react to a slave movie, as you know by now. The topic of Bloodstained is slavery for season one. So I will be doing and uploading monthly movie reactions where I watch a slave movie, tell you my thoughts about it. We watch it together. You can comment on that and interact with me there. You will also get a monthly blog post where I detail some YouTube tips if you're an aspiring YouTuber or content creator. Just get little tips that I think that it's important for anyone who's just starting out to know. That will also be included. On top of that, you guys will be first to know of any merch, of any pre-sales, of anything like that. So be aware of that. And I am in the middle of writing a novel. And I would love your guys' input on it. And I will be posting excerpts on the paid Substack from here and there, just to see what you guys think about it. Now, all of that you will get from the paid version. So you'll get everything that I said from the free version, as well as all of those extra things from the paid version. Now, you may be wondering, all of that stuff, how much does a paid tier cost? The paid tier is $5, $5 a month, and you'll get all of that extra content from me. So I hope you're into that. I hope you're excited for it. Hit the link in the bio to go to my Substack and become a follower, become a subscriber to the newsletter to The Swan. So
Bloodstained Episode 0 was an episode that I tacked on the beginning in order to allow us to be able to jump right into the nitty-gritty immediately. It was important for me to set the foundation on the history of slavery and the existence of the era of slave trade and how that kind of trickles into what we will be talking about throughout the series. Now, if you haven't listened to that episode, go down. Link is in the bio. Click that. Check it out. I think you do need to listen to that episode before you listen to this one. Bloodstained is episodic. It is not anthology style. So remember, every episode builds. It's a slow burn. You get it. So officially episode one, we are going to be talking about the transatlantic slave trade, specifically the triangle trade, and just some more basic foundational things. You know, we covered some foundational things in episode zero. This is an extension of that. We're going to get more into my opinions. We're going to get more into shaping this into a true crime story, which I hope you're pumped about. But again, like I said, we need to build the foundation so we can get more into the other more higher level topics. As previously stated in episode zero, that Arab slave trade was really the beginning of the global concept of slavery, the global institution of slavery, being able to take people from one place and use them as free labor in another place. The transatlantic slave trade was just a further extension of this, an improvement on a design. Without all of those centuries of figuring out how it all works and all of this, actual trade pattern was established that enriched all of the Western world. It is important to note that the Atlantic slave trade isn't just something that's tacked on Black History Month to teach people very vaguely about how things are the way that they are, at least racially. It's important to understand that the transatlantic slave trade is the foundation for every European nation on this planet to reach wealth, influence, power unheard of. It solidified Europeans' reign, the Western reign over the entire globe. So what is a transatlantic slave trade? Now, the transatlantic slave trade is a name for a system that ultimately brought slaves from Africa to the Americas, including North America, obviously Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean. It lasted around 400 years and again solidified Europe's power. Now, the majority of enslaved Africans came from six specific regions in Africa. I'm reading my notes, so forgive me. Senegambia, Sierra Leone, the Windward Coast, Gold Coast, Bight of Benin, the Bight of Biafra, and West and Central Africa, aka the Congo and Angola. So likely, if you are descendant of chattel slavery in the Americas, you are from Western Africa. It is estimated anywhere between 12 million to 20 million Africans were enslaved and brought to the Americas by way of the Atlantic slave trade. Now, it's important for me to say this as often as possible because I was shook when I learned this for the first time, but there was a point in time when the Arab slave trade and the Atlantic slave trade were funneling millions of enslaved Africans out of Africa at the same time. The Arab slave trade started in the 7th century and lasted into the 1960s of our modern day. So it predated and postdated the transatlantic slave trade. I think that's really important for us to understand and to grasp when we're trying to understand and conceptualize racialized chattel slavery, the generational trauma in the continent of Africa and all of these things. So remember, there was hundreds of years in that time frame where on the eastern coast of Africa, the Arabs were funneling slaves, millions of slaves to Arab countries, to the Red Sea, all over the place. And on the western side of Africa, the triangle trade was funneling millions of slaves to the Americas and to Europe. Now, I want to take a moment and just acknowledge the actual scale of these slave trades. The 12 to 20 million people that were taken from the continent of Africa and funneled to the Americas through the triangle trade, that was an estimated number. A greatly estimated number. You are not accounting for the amount of people that were killed along the way. You are not accounting for how these families had such great losses after their family members were taken into slavery. You're not accounting for the slave rebellions in Africa and who passed away defending their freedom. You're not accounting for the way in which Africa as a continent completely changed after this and would never be the same. There is immeasurable loss, incalculable loss that can be associated with either slave trade. But understanding conceptually that is associated, all of that weight of loss is associated with the Atlantic slave trade, not to mention the Arab slave trade was happening at the same time. So again, all of the numbers when we're talking about these things are greatly estimated and probably greatly reduced when we're talking about impact and power and loss and grief and change and control. I think what frustrates me most in conversations in the just general mixed company about slavery is that it was kind of a lapse in judgment, or it was what was popular at the time, or, you know, there's this like acknowledgement of how terrible it was to create such a system, but also this demand that they should be forgiven for that system, even though they still benefit from that system. Incalculable loss, obviously, when it comes to the body count, but the fact that these systems are still dominating us so many years after to this modern day in 2024 just brings it all the more sharper. The way in which we're taught about slavery is usually as an afterthought, and it's usually with, you know, an appropriate layer of white guilt, but also an appropriate layer of vagueness in order to allow for them to dodge the full weight of responsibility when it comes to creating a system so brutal and so focused on the exploitation of other human beings. Okay, so let's talk specifically about the transatlantic slave trade, or where it's commonly referred to as the triangle trade, because it looked like a triangle. I don't know why I tried to do that with my hands holding a mic. Forgive me. Okay, so the triangle trade, basically, this is how it would go. The first leg of the triangle trade brought iron, alcohol, and gunpowder and textiles from Europe to Africa's western coast. So all of those things would come from Europe to the west coast of Africa, where they would unload all of those items and exchange that for slaves, captured African slaves. They would take those slaves, put them into the bottom of the boat, either a tight pack or a loose pack. I can show you pictures of either, but basically it is as the name is, alludes to. A tight pack is fitting as many enslaved people on top of each other as close and as tight as possible in order to maximize the profits. Because, of course, you have to account for all the ones that are going to die along the middle passage. The loose pack was, more space, less people fit in just like sardines. Of course, they still were, but it was less so. And the goal of the loose pack was kind of to avoid excess death by the tight pack, because disease couldn't spread as easily and people were just in generally in better conditions. So you have the tight pack and the loose pack. So basically, all the European goods would go to the west of Africa, then they'd bring the slaves onto the ship, tight pack, loose pack, go across the Middle Passage to the Americas, okay, where they would sell their enslaved cargo, and in exchange, they would probably get raw materials like cotton or indigo or tobacco or, you know, the raw materials needed to send up to Europe again so they could have their factories refine them into other goods. And that trade would just continuously go like that for 400 years. If you weren't here, you were here, you were here, you were here.
Socials, baby. Let's talk socials. Hi, my name is Madison, the creator behind the Madison Swan channel. You are here, you are watching my video. Hi, bitch. Let's talk a little bit about my socials. Hit the link in the bio, okay? Hit that link tree. Look at all those links, okay? Now, I will give you 5 seconds to subscribe to the Swan on the following links, okay? Hit those links, subscribe to me, follow me on those platforms. I give you a little bit more of who I am, a little bit more of my personality, a little bit more of my day-to-day. I promise I will be posting more on Instagram. That is my goal for this year, so look out for that. But take your time. I'll count to 5. And just type in, just go into the description. I made it easy for you. Go to the link tree and click and follow the Swan and all those links. 5, 4, 3, 2, 2.5, 1. Okay, wasn't that so hard? But while you're at it, you might as well like, comment, and subscribe to the channel and hit that notification bell. Ah, love you. Back to the video.
I think we're all told the Middle Passage story is a horror story. I feel like we rarely in history class get firsthand accounts. I'm sure a lot of these firsthand accounts of what the Middle Passage was like to experience are lost to history. But when we're told about the Middle Passage, we're just told it's bad. You know, they were too close, sickness, you know, people died next to you, stuff like that, which, you know, already is unimaginable uncomfortability. But I thought it would be important to have a firsthand account of somebody who was captured in Africa, made it through the Middle Passage, sold into slavery on the other side, and eventually became free and became one of the most vocal abolitionists to this day. His name was Olada Ikwano, and I'm just going to read his firsthand account. I'm sorry, I can't memorize all of this, so I'm just going to read it, and you're just going to have to deal with it. Also, an important thing to note, too, is that it is estimated that over 2 million enslaved Africans were killed on the journey from Africa to the Americas through the Middle Passage. So keep that in mind. But let us get into the horrors by Olada Ikwano. Okay, so just so you know who he is, he was born in 1745 and died on March 31st, 1797. He went most of his life going by Gustavus Vasa, was a writer and abolitionist born in the village of Isaka in modern southern Nigeria. Nigeria. He was enslaved in Africa as a child and was shipped to the Caribbean and sold to a Royal Navy officer. He was sold twice before being able to purchase his own freedom in 1766, which was an extreme rarity. We'll talk more about that later. As a freeman, Ikwuanu supported the London abolitionist movement. He was part of the abolitionist group called the Sons of Africa, whose members were Africans living in Britain. He became a leader in the British abolitionist movement in the 1780s and solidified his place in history with publishing his memoir in 1789. His memoir was called The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Ulata Ikwuanu. That book basically was central in the passage of the British Slave Trade Act in 1807, which abolished the slave trade and sold so well in his lifetime that 9 editions were published. This is his description of the journey on the slave ship. The first object which saluted my eyes when I arrived on the coast was the sea and a slave ship, which was then riding at anchor and waiting for its cargo. These filled me with astonishment, which was soon converted into terror, which I am yet at a loss to describe, nor the then feelings of my mind. When I was carried on board, I was immediately handled and tossed up to see if I were sound by some of the crew, and I was now persuaded that I was got into a world of bad spirits, and that they were going to kill me. Their complexions, too, differing so much from ours, their long hair, and the language they spoke, which was very different from any I had ever heard, united to confirm me in this belief. Indeed, which were the horrors of my views and fears at the moment, that if 10,000 worlds had been my own, I would have freely parted with them all to have exchanged my condition with that of the meanest slave in my own country. When I looked around the ship, too, and saw a large furnace of copper boiling and a multitude of black people of every description chained together, every one of their countenances expressing dejection and sorrow, I no longer doubted of my fate, and quite overpowered with horror and anguish, I fell motionless on the deck and fainted. When I recovered a little, I found some black people about me who I believe were some of those who brought me on board and had received their pay. They talked to me in order to cheer me, but all in vain. I asked them if we were not to be eaten by these white men with horrible looks, red faces, and long hair. They told me I was not, and one of the crew brought me a small portion of spirituous liquor in a wine glass. But being afraid of him, I would not take it out of his hand. One of the blacks, therefore, took it from him and gave it to me, and I took a little down my palate, which, instead of reviving me, as they thought it would, threw me into the greatest consternation at the strange feeling it produced, having never tasted any such liquor before. Soon after this, the blacks who brought me on board went off and left me abandoned to despair. I now saw myself deprived of all chance of returning to my native country, or even the slightest glimpse of hope of gaining the shore which I now considered as friendly. And I even wished for my former slavery in preference to my present situation, which was filled with horrors of every kind, still heightened by my ignorance of what I was to undergo. I was not long suffered to indulge my grief. I was soon put down under the decks, and there I received such a salutation to my nostrils as I had ever experienced in my life, so that with the loathsomeness of the stench and crying together, I became so sick and low that I was not able to eat, nor had I the least desire to taste anything. I now wished for the last time death to relieve me, but soon to my grief, two of the white men offered me eatables, and on refusing to eat, one of them held me fast by the hands and laid me across, I think the window lass, and tied my feet, while the other flogged me severely. I had never experienced anything of this kind before, and although not being used to the water, I naturally feared that element the first time I saw it.
Boo! Yes, I know, this is shocking. For those of you who are audio-only people, check out the visuals. You will see what I'm talking about. I'm literally here in a face mask, and I had to slap something together so I could finish out this podcast episode. Unfortunately, for everyone involved, you will not see me looking cute for the rest of this episode because the audio got corrupted. Something went wrong. I don't know what went wrong, but this whole second half of the podcast was super echoey that I just could not justify continuing it throughout the last 30 minutes of this podcast. Like, I just couldn't do that to you guys. I couldn't do that to your ears. So what I decided to do as you saw from the previous clip, how echoey it was becoming, I just thought I would pop on here, finish the reading, finish my final thoughts on why I think the transatlantic slave trade is a true crime story, and just do it straight, no chaser, with better audio so everyone can, like, you know, be cool about it. Again, if you cannot see me right now, you're lucky. But if you want to see me, go to my YouTube channel, the Madiswan channel, and you will be able to see the visual components to this podcast, which are available for free for everybody. Now, I'm going to finish this reading. I'm so sorry. My reading was so horrible in the first part of this. I'm going to just pick up where I left off, finish this reading, and then we're going to get to my final thoughts. How about that? Let's get into it. I naturally feared that element the first time I saw it, yet nevertheless, could I have got over the nettings, I would have jumped over the side, but I could not. And besides, the crew used to watch us very closely, who were not chained down to the decks, lest we should leap into the water. And I have seen some of these poor African prisoners most severely cut for attempting to do so, and hourly whipped for not eating. This indeed was often the case with myself. In a little time after, amongst the poor chained men, I found some of my own nation, which in a small degree gave ease to my mind. I inquired of these men what was to be done with us. They gave me to understand we were to be carried to these white people's country to work for them. I then was a little relieved and thought if it were no worse than working, my situation was not so desperate. But still I feared I should be put to death. The white people looked and acted, as I thought, in so savage a manner, for I had never seen among any people such instances of brutality, cruelty, and this not only shown towards us blacks, but also some of the whites themselves. One white man in particular I saw, when we were permitted to be on deck, flogged so unmercifully with large rope near the foremast that he died in consequence of it, and they tossed him over the side as they would have done a brute. This made me fear these people the more, and I expected nothing less than to be treated in the same manner. I could not help expressing my fears and apprehensions to some of my countrymen. I asked them if these people had no country but lived in this hollow place, the ship. They told me they did not, but came from a distance. Then, said I, how comes in all our country we have never heard of them? They told me because they live so very far off. I then asked, where were their women? Had they any like themselves? And why, said I, do we not see them? They answered, because they were left behind. The stretch of the hold while we were on the coast was so intolerably loathsome that it was dangerous to remain there for any time, and some of us had been permitted to stay on the deck for the fresh air. But now that the whole ship's cargo were confined together, it became absolutely pestilent. The closeness of the place and the heat of the climate added to the number in the ship, which was so crowded that each had scarcely room to turn himself, almost suffocated us. This produced copious perspirations so that the air soon became unfit for respiration. From a variety of loathsome smells brought on a sickness amongst the slaves, of which many died. This wretched situation was again aggravated by the galling of the chains now become insupportable, and the filth of the necessary tubs into which the children often fell and were almost suffocated. The shrieks of the women and the groans of the dying rendered the whole a scene of horror, almost inconceivable. Happily, perhaps for myself, I was soon reduced so low here that it was thought necessary to keep me almost always on deck, and from my extreme youth, I was not put in fetters. In this situation, I expected every hour to share the fate of my companions, some of whom were almost daily brought upon deck at the point of death, which I began to hope would soon put an end to my miseries. Often did I think many of the inhabitants of the deep much more happy than myself. I envied them the freedom they enjoyed, and as often wished I could change my condition for theirs. Every circumstance I met with served only to render my state more painful and heighten my apprehensions and my opinion of the cruelty of the whites. One day, they had taken a number of fishes, and when they had killed and satisfied themselves with as many as they thought fit, to our astonishment, who were on the deck, rather than give any of them to us to eat, as we expected, they tossed the remaining fish into the sea again. although we begged and prayed for some as well as we could, but in vain. And some of my countrymen, being pressed by hunger, took an opportunity when they thought no one saw them of trying to get a little privately. But they were discovered, and the attempt produced them some very severe floggings. I and some few more slaves that were not sellable amongst the rest from very much fretting were shipped off in a sloop for North America. While I was in this plantation in Virginia, the gentleman to whom I suppose the estate belonged, being unwell, I was one day sent for to his dwelling house to fan him. When I came into the room where he was, I was very much frightened at some things I saw, and the more so as I had seen a black woman slave as I came through the house, who was cooking the dinner, and the poor creature was cruelly loaded with various kinds of iron machines. She had one particularly on her head, which locked her mouth so fast that she could scarcely speak, and could not eat nor drink. I was much astonished and shocked at this contraption, which I afterwards learned was called the iron muzzle. Now that, my dear friends, was the rest of the passage by Olado Equano, telling his firsthand experience of the Middle Passage, one of few experiences that survived history. As you could tell by his explanation, the experience sounds horrifying, but to me it sounds even more horrifying from the firsthand perspective, which we rarely get the chance to experience, which is why I thought it was important to put it in this episode. It explains firsthand the depravity of the experience. The interesting part that I like to point out was how the perception of the whites started to bloom based on how they were treated on the ship. Again, you have to remember and put this into context. A lot of these African slaves, enslaved Africans, came from the interior of Africa, right? They came from the interior, from their own people who captured them, and they were brought to the coast. At the coast is where they were then sold and put on the ship. So a lot of these enslaved people hadn't seen a white person, don't know their language, hadn't seen the ocean, as you saw in this passage. He was shocked and feared by the ocean. The only fear that surpassed that was the white person on the ship. He had no concept of who, what, where these people were from and what their deal was. So to imagine being forcefully taken from your home, from your family, from the people that know you, taken on a journey where most people didn't make it even to the coast. You know what I mean? Then to be experiencing seeing the ocean for the first time, seeing a white person for the first time, all in one moment, thrown, chained into the hull of the boat where everyone is packed in super closely. As he was explaining, the air was thick with perspiration, with moisture. Everyone was getting sick. You know, the filth in the room, the filth in the hull of the ship, all of these things you're experiencing for the first time. And he took the time to reflect on how that made him view the white man. Because quiet as it's kept, and I think white people forget this, they created this perception of what black people were supposed to be based on, you know, justifying slavery. But at the same token, we were figuring out who the fuck you were. And a lot of us started to get, based on truth, based on reality, this very negative and evil perception of whiteness. I mean, he talked about how they were beating up on their own on the ship. He talked about how they got all that fish and would not share even a little bit with them, not even the scraps with them. They didn't want to share shit. And he took that in his mind and was like, these people are especially cruel, are especially evil, are evil unknown. I think they forget that it goes both ways. Like, you perceived us and put perception on us, and we perceived you based on what you did to us. The difference is we based our perception on whiteness based on what was done to us, and you created the perception of blackness in order to further what you wanted to do. This ties into so many things in terms of understanding the Atlantic slave trade as a true crime story, as it rightfully should be understood as, because a lot of times when this is discussed, the blame gets shifted. It gets kind of vague. It's, oh, it was of the times and this is how it was done. And we are, you know, we are sad about it and we can't change the past. And that's how it's told to us. The truth of the matter is, if they really felt guilty about it, all of the institutions, all of the conceptions, all of the things that were based on the racial hierarchy that came out of slavery would also collapse, would have also ended when slavery ended. But yet they persist, right? Yet they persist. You know what I mean? And that is why I think that is a true crime story. That is where the true crime story aspect starts to get into it with me personally. I think a lot of people hear the story of slavery, hear the physical violence, hear the torture, hear the sexual assault, hear all of these things. And they're like, of course, this is true crime. Because to them, true crime is inherently violent. Of course it is, right? To me, violence isn't just the physical, it's the emotional, it's the psychological warfare that they created based off of this system in order to justify this system. And of that racial hierarchy that came out of this system, how many times can a bitch say system? I know. But of the racial hierarchy that was produced in order to justify the existence and the institution of slavery, so many things have happened. The value hierarchy, redlining, you know, the criminal justice system in general, mass incarceration, the crack epidemic, all of these things, even to the point of the psychological warfare has worked so well that it has even caused us to look at each other, those who were once one, to look at each other and to cause blame and to wreak havoc and to cause divisive bullshit within our own community. We're going to get into the diaspora wars next month, baby. Don't worry about it. And we'll get more into what I think about that. But this is a point to me that is a diabolical point. It's the lasting effect, the perception of what blackness is now as a result of slavery, right? We have done so much to try and combat the negative perception, but that perception is baked into everything that we do, everything that we do. It's baked into medicine, where my mother, a nurse, when she was going to nursing school, was literally taught that you have to use thicker needles and more force when you're taking or doing shots on black people because their skin is thicker. To the point where black women die at an exorbitant rate in a first world country when they give birth because of the racial perception of who we are. We're still being murdered to this day based on the psychological warfare that was created out of this system of slavery. So if they were actually sorry for it, if they actually didn't believe it should exist, if they actually had any remorse about slavery, then the entire thing would come down. But it doesn't. And that's the evil part. And this is what I was really trying to really hammer home in episode zero. I don't think I explained it that well, but I'm going to try and explain it now. It's not just the actual thing happening. It's also everything that came out of that thing happening. We're talking the racial hierarchy, which affects us to this day in all aspects of our lives, no matter what. It's also the way in which they choose to tell this history to you in order to evade guilt by purposely sanitizing it, censoring it, or flat out lying about what happened during these times so that you don't get the full scope and you are no longer able to place the full blame on who deserves it. You know what I mean? Justice cannot be served until the truth is exposed. And they know that. So that's why you're taught about slavery a certain way. That's why when a slave movie is up for an Oscar, it seems like it's the same fucking story. And why a lot of us black people don't really engage in slave movies or watching slave movies. Shameless plug for me reacting to slave movies on Substack. Link in the bio to subscribe to my Substack. But that's why a lot of us don't engage with that stuff, because it's always the same story. It's never an empowering story. It has the same tropes. It has the same discussion points. And I get more into that in my series on my Substack, which you can go and check out now if you want to. But there's a whole apparatus at play. When you look at it from a bird's eye view, there's a whole intricate machinery working to uphold the hierarchy that came out of slavery. And that is why it's a true crime story. It's a true crime story because even though slavery is abolished, slavery is still killing people. And the fact that we aren't told the truth of the history of that allows that to continue to persist. The ignorance begets complacency in the face of mass incarceration, prison slave labor, you know, criminalizing poverty. All of these things are meant to do the same thing. Slavery never went anywhere. It just changed up its approach. You know what I mean? And that's why I'm choosing to talk about it in a different way that fundamentally has the victim and the predator narrative built into it, because we have to see it for what it is. It's an attack. It's a constant attack. The system that exists and is reified that came out of slavery is a serial killer, and it continues to kill us. And it continues to torture us, and it continues to enslave us. One of the most important aspects, and I'll leave it here because, you know, the episode was longer before the audio got corrupted, but I'll leave it here. This will be a short and sweet episode for us. I want us to close out with us understanding the importance of a start date. To me, a start date is the point in which something began. Put a pin in that. When you take any social science class, the basis of all of it that will get mentioned in every class from 101 to 300 is the concept of nature versus nurture. How I was taught about nature versus nurture, or that debate, is essentially that, okay, if I right now had a baby on camera and that baby was, you know, studied, would that baby be born with 100% of its, you know, traits, its personality, its viewpoint in life? Or is that nurtured by society? Now, leave it to me, social scientist girl here. All things in social sciences, in sociology specifically, are a mixture of both things. That no binaries don't exist. It's always a mixture. The concept of nature versus nurture is simply that, understanding what is natural to the human condition and what is nurtured out of the society that we create, the society that you're raised in, your community, what nurtures you to become who you are, right? Now, I want to take that a step further. And I want to use a case study that is current, that all of us have suffered and seen on our timelines multiple times, which is the epidemic of men with podcasts, men with dating podcasts, specifically the Manosphere, the Red Pill guys, right? You're scrolling on TikTok, and it's likely that you've come across a clip of a shitty podcast with shitty men talking about women and how they're horrible and how they hate us and this, this, and that. And it's likely when you saw that clip, you saw one of the men in that podcast saying, well, women are just naturally better at nurturing. They're just naturally better at taking care of home and family. And that's why that's their responsibility. I'm supposed to provide, I'm supposed to protect, and that's my responsibility, right? When it comes to the family dynamics. But that's true technically. What I mean by that is if you choose to take a bird's eye view and you understand that the society that we exist within is white, male-centered, wealthy-centered, capitalistic, homophobic, cishet, like all of the different things, patriarchal. If you understand that society has been based on those tenets, modern day society has been based on those tenets as we understand it, you have to understand that you are perceived through that lens, through the lens of the oppressor who creates the system. So me as a Black woman is being looked through by society through the lens of the person that created the system to benefit them the most. All of our identities are looked and filtered with and through that lens. So if you're a woman in a society based on the tenets that our society has been based on, you are going to be put into a strict box of what you're capable of, what your position is, what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to be, how you're supposed to act. And us as women understand this, you know, we've been pushing against the boundaries and the borders of these strict boundaries for such a long time to prove that we are capable of more than what people perceive us to be capable of, right? In my grandma's day, you know, she couldn't own her own credit card. Now I can. You know what I mean? We're constantly pushing against these boundaries of how of our potential that is put on us by the white supremacist society that we are existing within. So when someone comes at you and says, well, it's natural for women to be the nurturers and the this and the take care of the house and the this and the this, you have to remove that from the zeitgeist that we contextualize that in. Because a lot of people will hear that, they've heard it a million times before in a million different ways, and they say, yeah, that's true, that's true. We were never able to be anything else. We were socialized to be the nurturer, to be the caregiver, to be the support system, always, and forced to be socialized in that way at that. It wasn't a choice. We were forced to be put into that box. We were forced to be put in that position. So generationally, yeah, because society is based on that, we are going to be taught how to be more emotionally intelligent, more aware, more concerned with nurturing things. And that's generationally passed down. You know what I mean? So when you live in a society that forces women to live in this very, very tight parameters of what's acceptable, and at that, you are barely out of the womb before you get your first baby doll and your first kitchen set and your first tea set and everything you own is pink and you're weird if you don't like the dress-up toys and the gowns and the princesses and all of that shit. Like, if you look at it like that, and then you understand, and then you scroll on TikTok and you see a fucking balding man sit up there and say, well, that's what women do. That's all that they're good for. This is natural to them. They're supposed to do this. When in reality, we were never socialized to do anything else. That doesn't mean we're only good at this. It just means we were forced to only be able to be good at this. So when you take that, right? You take that example of what's natural to a woman, for example, right? And then you start to peel it apart and you see, okay, well, that's only natural to us because we weren't able to do anything else. Is it really natural? Is that really natural? Or is that nurtured by the society that we exist within, by the parameters and the boundaries that are put on top of us, right? And then when you start going down that rabbit hole, I don't mean to give you an existential crisis, child, I don't. But when you start going down that rabbit hole of all of these social things, these social constructions, and you start to kind of pick at it, you know, what else is thought to be natural for a Black woman? What else is thought to be natural for a Black man? What is natural to being a man? What is natural to being a woman? What's natural to being a child? And how much of that is actually biological? And how much of that is what you're told to be generationally? And how you're told to exist? And when you remove that you were told to exist that way, what could you be? Women were thought to be like children that you had sex with, basically, at a point in time. You know what I mean? And now the idea and the existence of birth control really helped this. But the idea of a woman CEO is an alien. It just is. So that leads me down the rabbit hole of understanding that what's natural to us, to any of us that exists in this society, is fluid, because all of those things are subject to change depending on what's normal at the time, right? What's allowed and permitted at the time. You see what I mean? When you start picking at these things, and I implore you to start picking at these things, more people need to ask why. It just needs to start happening. But when you start picking at these things and researching these things and looking at why we believe this and why this happens this way, why, eventually that why is going to lead you to a point in time that was a start date. Eventually, you'll get to the point where you see that women in other societies and other cultures were not perceived in the same way. And then you're able to see a point in time when that shifted. And when was that point in time? And what is that point in time called? A fucking start date. If you're nature or biological tendencies have a start date attached to it, it's likely that it was a man-made creation and it was a social construction. If women existing in these very strict parameters has a start date attached to it, then inherently it's not natural, because natural things don't have a start date to them. They just happen and always happen. Let's bring that concept to race, because people, you know, struggle with the difference between nationality, race, and ethnicity. People struggle with that daily, Jow. Sometimes I do. But when it comes to things like race and why so many people in social sciences see race as a social construction, is because the racial hierarchy that we go off of has a fucking start date. And that start date is fucking slavery. What you're constantly being hammered home, whether that's consciously or subconsciously, about what a Black person actually is. The nightly news, movies, videos, YouTube, all these things that we're inundated as soon as we leave the threshold hole of our home. What is a Black person to you? What do you perceive a Black person to be? What do they represent? All of that is created based off of a concept of Blackness that was created to justify slavery existing. I say all of this to say that if your natural biological tendencies, for those who are listening to audio, I'm doing air quotes, obviously, if those tendencies have a fucking start date, then they can have a fucking end date. If those things can have a start date, bitch, that can have an end date, and we can change up what the perception is moving forward. These natural things are a lot more fluid than they would like to let you know they are. So the concept of race, the hierarchical nature of race that they keep telling us in so many ways that, yes, it's fucked up, but we can't do anything about it because it's natural and it's this and it's that, is all man-made. And when you look at it like that, you start to understand how fucking diabolical it is that a man would create a system like this. And then you start to feel like our good friend Oladu Equano, when he was watching those white people throw them fish back into the damn ocean. Do you guys have a natural tendency to be greedy and evil and just horrible? Do you have a bloodlust that is unquenchable? Is that why you are in so much power and control of the world? Are we the savages? Or are you? Okay, on that note, we're gonna leave it there. We will leave the conversation there and we will pick back the conversation up where we will be discussing the diaspora wars. Yes, we will be talking about the diaspora wars as a way to really discuss the way that slavery was different in the colonies versus Central South America and the Caribbean. We're going to detail that history, but we're also going to talk about how that specific history leads us down the road of the diaspora wars, or at least my perception as to why. With that being said, I just want to close out and say, hit the link in the bio, subscribe to the Swan on all of the links in that link tree. I really, really appreciate you guys. I just want to take a moment to just genuinely thank you guys. This month has been kind of a whirlwind for me. My 23-year-old car died on me, which of course it did because it was 23 fucking years old, but it was still inconvenient nonetheless. But in that same week that that happened, I reached 10,000 subscribers, 120,000 on my TikTok, and I got over 50 new subscribers to my Substack, and it's growing. We love it there. It's live there. We're building community there. If you're curious about that, again, hit the link in the link tree to subscribe to the Swan and all of the things. But I just want to genuinely say thank you, whether you're new here or you've been here. I love you. I appreciate you so, so much. Without further ado, all I have to say is Black Lives Matter, free Palestine until it's backwards, baby, and stay tuned for episode 2. Mwah.